Hi, today is March 30th, 2018. This is Mobile Views Podcast 248. I'm Todd Agasawa with my good friend John Westfall. And we've actually got a bunch of interesting stuff this week, unlike many weeks where we just kind of talk because it's fun to talk.
Yeah, we have some things that we are experts in some sense. So we will actually have some knowledge base behind some of this. And
yeah,
of course,
that's
I have
a little
rant.
Different. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, John has a rant, which I don't quite get, but we'll get to it. We'll get to it. Okay, first thing is a real short one I wanted to note, and that is that Google Home, including Google Home Mini, which I use, can now work with a Bluetooth speaker. And you might say, what? It didn't before? And yes, it didn't before. It's kind of useless, actually, from, you know, I think you can plug in a speaker. Not sure. I've looked at it. The speaker itself is not very good. I would say that the Echo Dot probably has a slightly better speaker, but that's just me. And definitely the regular size Echo is a way better speaker than the Google Home Mini, at least. So I might try the Bluetooth speaker, see if I like it. I still prefer using the Echo. The next thing is I'm going to let John roll on this one because I found it interesting, but I don't claim to have any knowledge of this. And that's, I think, a University of Arizona professor is using data from the, University of Arizona professor Sudha Ram is using the student ID cards that are used by students to do various things on campus, like, you know, grab food and stuff, to predict dropouts of freshmen. Mm-hmm. And so, John, you're a university professor. How do you...
Well, I'm a university professor who also, as part of my job, works in the... I work out of, obviously, the psychology department, but I also work out of what we call our Student Success Center, which is basically an entire group of services designed to prevent students from dropping out. Mm-hmm. We call it Student Success, and it is Student Success because we want students to graduate. But the more important thing is we need to know what's stopping them from graduating, and dropping out is generally the thing that stops them from graduating.
That's a showstopper for sure.
Yeah, although there are some that occasionally will kind of just linger, and so you have to kind of push them along. But anyway, so what this professor at the University of Arizona did was he requested the data from his internal institutional research group to find out where students were using their ID cards. A lot of the modern-day college ID cards are also, in a sense, a debit card. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have anyone that's been in college lately, or you haven't been in it, your college ID now is typically used not just for identification purposes, but everything from door swipe access to different buildings to dorm rooms to just everything that you can imagine an ID card now could be used, including flexible spending accounts, swiping at dining halls, all those things. So if you have a large distributed network, basically a small credit card network that you're running as a university, you know that students are coming to the dining hall at this certain time. You know that they're swiping their card at the local McDonald's at this other time. You've got a lot of data on what they're doing. And when you marry that data to outcome or predictors of student success, academic success in the old days was simply measured by GPA and standing and all these things that happen at the end of the semester or at the end of term. But now we're very much interested in things that are happening not at the end, but during the semester, because as is noted in this article that we'll link to, students make the decision to drop out not at the end when they get their final grades, but midway through, sometimes early on. And if you can catch them early on and figure out why they're thinking of dropping out, you know, I'm not doing well in a certain class, I don't know what I want to do, maybe I'm in the wrong major. Mm-hmm. If you can catch that early within the first few weeks that it's happening, through any sort of early alert mechanism, mm-hmm. you can make a big difference in your retention numbers. And the University of Arizona, in this piece, they talk about how they've had a 3% retention bump in the last year. That's a pretty big bump for a single year change. At my own institution, we've had over the last 4 years a 14.7% retention bump. Mm. So you're trying to find all the various things firing on all cylinders that will let you catch these students and get them the support system they need in place before they decide, screw it, I'm just going to leave. So the implications of this research is simply what is predictive of success. And if you know what's predictive, even if it's not causal, which none of this research is causal, it's just correlational, you can at least start to look for certain patterns. You can at least, you know, give a survey to your students early on and say, hey, what do you do on Thursday nights, Friday nights? Where do you go, et cetera, et cetera? And if you see that you've got a student that is struggling who also is engaging some of these behaviors that are predictive of them ultimately dropping out, you can try to intervene early and you can get them the support they need.
Yeah, and if you go to the Arizona Central, azcentral.com website where this where we found this article, there's a graph that's unfortunately very hard to read. I've just enlarged it in my screen and I can't really see much. But there's a very, you know, there's a couple of key nodes. In fact, I would say there's a one single node that everything else connects to there, which is kind of interesting. And then at the periphery, you see things like, I assume they're either dormitories or the names of cafeterias. And then you see things you recognize like Starbucks. And, I don't recognize the seller, but I assume that's somewhere that they grab a coffee or something. And you can kind of see where people are clustering together is my guess is how this is a data visualization shows traffic patterns of a University of Arizona freshman. And so you can see where they go from, you know, one place to another. So it's a pretty interesting graph. I wish I knew more about what the actual, vertices meant in the. Mm-hmm. In the graph.
And in the end, it's looking for anything. You know, we found about a year and a half ago that there were certain dorms that just if you were living in those dorms, you had a much higher rate of dropping out. And we have different dorms on campus that are unused. And so the decision was, well, let's close that one cluster of dorms.
Yeah.
And move these students to a different part of campus, maybe into a building where, in this case, these dorms had a bit of a reputation for being kind of party central on campus. And they were situated in the perfect place to have a party. It was basically four dorms, a little courtyard in the middle. And the community was not happy with the university's decision to close this because they remembered, a lot of them were alum, a lot of them remember those parties.
And they liked
them. But in the end, they liked them when they were students. And in the end, it was a decision that, you know, these student groups can still have their get-togethers, they can still have things to do, but they aren't attracting as much attention and, in this case, as little oversight as they were in that situation. But it's data mining that's helping, in the end, everyone. There's no one that is hurt by higher student retention.
So has enough time passed for you to gather data to assess that change? Did it make a difference?
For that particular one change, we haven't had enough time pass.
Okay.
But there are certainly other changes. So, for example, I run our university's first-year seminar program, which is basically a workshop that is a once-a-week, one-hour-a-week workshop that our students attend. And we know that students that attend it are retained at about a 3 or 4% higher rate than those who decide not to take the course, decide not to participate. And that's both with freshman students and transfer students. So it's things like that after 3 or 4 years you look at and go, yeah, this is, with everything else being held static, this is causing a difference and we should put more effort behind it and put more resources behind it because we want those retention numbers as high as possible.
Yeah. And I assume, as you said earlier, you noted that the University of Arizona's, not manipulation, but I guess just kind of correlation analysis, indicated that changes to things created a 3 to 4% retention bump in 1 year, and you said that was a significant retention increase, even though it doesn't sound like much to, you know, a person not familiar with the situation.
Yeah, you're talking about the 80.5% to an 83.3%.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big bump for a 1 year retention change.
Nice. So, nice.
But it's interesting, and it's something I think when we talk with parents, and you know, parents are obviously very nervous about sending their children to school.
Oh, tell me about that. Mine just graduated last year.
yeah, what's going to happen, and will they do what they're supposed to be doing? And so anything that we can do that, like I said, there's really no loser. The student is more likely to get the degree they need. Mm-hmm. The parent is more likely to be happy writing those checks for tuition versus unhappy. The entire ecosystem works a lot better when students are succeeding versus when they're failing.
Okay. As one of the parents who was writing the checks for an undergrad degree for my daughter and is writing one for a graduate degree, happy is not the operative word when I'm signing those checks.
happier. I would venture a guess that if you were to find out that your daughter was not doing so well in school and you were still writing those checks, you'd be a little bit less happy to write them. Than
you are correct, sir. You are very correct. Alrighty, moving on to some actual news. A couple of actual news pieces, because Apple made a whole bunch of announcements, including the iPad, which we'll talk about a little later before your rant.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, something that's already released. So they released WatchOS 4.3 and iOS 11.3. WatchOS 4.3, the only two big things I notice is what people are calling the return of controlling music on the iPhone. From your watch, which I didn't know had disappeared because I guess I never do that. And also, I guess you can control music on your HomePod from your watch if you so choose to do. I didn't realize that it disappeared. I thought I could always do that.
Honestly, I hadn't realized it disappeared either.
Yeah.
So
shows you how much we use.
But I do like that feature. I use the watch to control music more often in the car over Bluetooth, or actually my Sonos system now, with the latest update about 4 or 5 months ago, lets you control Sonos from the watch. Yeah. So that can be kind of nice. And also from the lock screen on the iPad or on the iPhone.
Yeah. And the other, new feature, something else I guess I didn't really care about, is that the nightstand mode orientation is now flexible, which I guess it wasn't previously.
Well, and that's something that is honestly about a year and a half too late, because when nightstand mode was first released, it was basically only usable, obviously, in landscape mode, and all of the stands that were on the market at that time pretty much held the phone or the watch in portrait, so you really had no way to use that nightstand feature. So I'm happy to see that they've changed that to be much more friendly.
Yeah. And on the iOS 11.3 front, now this is something I haven't really been bothered by yet, but I'm sure it will happen. So I'm using a now older phone. I have an iPhone 7 Plus, which means it's a generation behind now. Is it over 2 years old? No, it's not 2 years old. It's a year and a half old. And you can now disable performance throttling on older phones due to degrading battery life. Now, I haven't felt the need to do that yet, but I'm sure it will happen someday, and I guess I'll be happy when that happens. But right now, with the battery life on my iPhone 7 Plus, that's, like I said, about a year and a half old now, it's fine. I don't have any issues with it. The other one is some stuff I really didn't look deeply into, and that's it has some AR enhancements. And this one is weird. I still understand this. So when you look at an app in the App Store, you can now sort app reviews. I haven't tried that yet, and I don't exactly know why I would want to try that, but okay. Now, the other one that's kind of interesting and kind of scary is you can now autofill username password in apps, which, you know, there are several apps, I think, that allow you to do that, but now it's built into iOS, so I guess things like LastPass are going to wither on the vine, but I'm still not sure I want to do that. I don't know if that's safe to, you know, autofill.
And I've used that a little bit. I mean, it depends on whose password ecosystem you want to trust.
Yeah.
Apple's is a pretty strong system from what I've seen with it in terms of keeping the iCloud keychain secure and those sorts of things. That's so I don't really worry about it too much, but I do understand kind of the hesitation anytime you extend things out with people going, do I really want this to be something that...
And I've never used any of those autofill apps that are already available, you know, so... and it's mostly because I still don't have a sense of trust for those things.
Hmm.
I'm not saying they're not trustworthy. I'm just saying I personally don't have a sense of trust for those things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one... Okay, so the next one and last item that I'm aware of that's new in iOS 11.3 is actually a bug fix. And I don't know if you've noticed this, John, but sometimes when you're typing on your iPhone, or iPad for that matter, some words have their first letter capitalized for no apparent reason. For me, the word house, H-O-U-S-E, is often capitalized. Now, I don't type the word house a lot, but the few times I have, I've noticed the H is capitalized, and I can't figure out why. But apparently that has been fixed, so I'm looking forward to that. Did you notice anything new in 11.3 or...
I really haven't, and I am a little bit annoyed that we didn't get some of the things that we were promised on the way. So I, even though I don't think I will use them that often, iMessage on web, I think, or iMessage on iCloud, I think would be really nice to have access to, especially at random times when I'm not on a Apple device. So I do use a Surface Pro. It would be nice to have that ability to check those things.
Yeah, that was a wonderful, or is a wonderful feature in Google Voice for people who use that service. So, let's see. Yeah, I guess we can briefly, before we get into the iPad, I guess we can briefly mention things that didn't weren't announced that I'm disappointed by. Thing number one, no new iPad mini.
Yeah.
Which to me would be, I don't know if I'd use the word perfect, but would probably be a desirable... device for the K through 12 group that they're trying to address with the new iPad that we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, if it would be desirable or not. I could see it being desirable with certain applications in education, but textbooks typically don't scale well to smaller screens. Textbooks are typically larger. And if you want someone drawing or doing other things that are more creative, I guess the smaller screen isn't as useful. But I do wish that there was some really compelling reason to use it in the education market, because then maybe Apple would decide to release another one.
Yeah, well, I'll say this. You know, when a child is young, and by young, let's say K through 4, a regular-sized iPad, which I'll define as 9.7 inches, is really big. I mean, it's really big to tote around, right? And, you know, even when my daughter was little, I think I gave her an iPad when she was, golly, I'm trying to remember now, 6th, 7th grade? She's kind of on the petite side, so even then, the 9.7-inch iPad was kind of big for her to tote around. And in high school, their high school actually handed out iPads to all the students, so, you know, she did carry around then. And by then, you know, she was kind of a regular-sized person, so... it wasn't much of an issue, but I think for young small children, you know, iPad mini would probably be desirable just from a point of view of lugging something around all day. And of course, you know, the other thing it means is, since we didn't get any iPad mini for of any kind, we didn't get an iPad mini Pro with pencil support, so those, because I really would like to draw on an iPad mini. I mean, I can, it's just, you know, I prefer to use the Apple Pencil.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I have other styluses that I enjoy using from time to time, but I use the Apple Pencil way more than any of them.
Yeah, because it's so much better.
Mm-hmm.
Even the other Bluetooth type pencils, like the Pencil by 53, which I also have. But anyway, the other disappointment, I mean, this was a week of disappointments, right?
I guess we're just really bitter about things.
Yeah, so no Mac Mini. Refresh. Yeah. It hasn't been refreshed in, what, 3 years now or something crazy
That poor thing is just not going to get refreshed.
Yeah, I think, but you know what? Where there's, you know, there's life, there's hope kind of thing. it's still in their product line. I still hope they'll refresh it someday. You know, it could happen. Probably won't, but it could happen. You know, something I don't have in our show notes that was refreshed that I didn't note is iWorks.
Mm-hmm.
So the various iWorks app can now be used with a pencil to draw right in the app. I haven't tried it yet, and quite frankly, I don't use iWorks. So.
Yeah, I used to use iWorks quite a bit, especially when I had a Mac at my desk at work. But now I use Microsoft Office for pretty much everything, like most of the world.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not as exciting to me as it would have been maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, same here. And back then, or even further back, I was actually using like the iWorks spreadsheet kind of things to do stuff while on the run, because it actually did a pretty good job of a lot of things that, you know, better than Excel, although it wasn't quite as powerful in my opinion. But yeah, that was, you know, kind of interesting. You still use iWorks. I don't know how many people still do. All right, so next up is the main thing before we get to John's rant, and I'm a little afraid of his rant, but anyway. So Apple did announce a new iPad. It's kind of a weird new iPad. It's kind of a, I'm going to call it the iPad Semi-Pro.
I think that's a good name for it. Yeah. I think that's an accurate descriptor.
Yeah, yeah, it's, you know, kind of like a, I don't know. Anyway, it's Semi-Pro.
Yeah. It's the iPad starter kit.
Yeah, so, you know, the price is good. I mean, it starts at $329, but that's for 32 gigabytes of storage, so essentially useless. It doesn't have a 64 gig option. It's either 32 or 128, so, you know, basically got to go to 128, which I think bumps it up to, I don't know, $379, $400, something like that. Still doesn't have a keyboard at that price. It does support the Apple Pencil, which is good, right, even though it's not a Pro. But doesn't have a smart connector, so you can't use a smart connector keyboard. You got to use a Bluetooth. Although apparently Logitech has a educational case / keyboard that plugs into the Lightning port, so you don't have to use Bluetooth. But haven't tried it, so, and I haven't read any reviews of it, so I have no idea how it looks. I think it has chiclet keys and things, so it's not a, you know, it's kind of a hardened device for kids. It doesn't look like something you want to use, but still. The new iPad is 9.7 inches, which is a bit smaller screen display than the 10.5 of a current iPad Pro, 10.5. Supports Pencil, doesn't have a smart connector, has a much faster processor than its predecessor, although, you know, I guess it's on par with the 10.5. I think it's an attractive device. I just don't think it's all that attractive for K-12 in particular.
Yeah, I think it's attractive if you don't use an iPad now. If you have thought about getting an iPad and you've thought, well, should I get one? Should I not get one? What will I get out of it? Will I get anything out of it? If those are the questions that you're thinking about and saying, maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't, this is probably a good iPad for that first 2 or 3 years that you're using an iPad, where you think, you know, what am I going to use this thing for?
Yeah. Well, then, go ahead.
Beyond that, you might want some of those Pro features.
Yeah. I was going to say that it's also good for people who've been wanting to upgrade from an older iPad, like the 2, which, you know, I was using until 2 years ago, or the, you know, what was called the new iPad, aka the iPad 3, or even some of the older Airs because of the Pencil support. And quite frankly, if you haven't upgraded your iPad in, say, 3 or 4 years, you're going to get quite a processor bump. So it'll be much faster, much better overall user experience. I think the screen is not quite as nice as the Pro. But you know what? I still find the iPad mini screen just fine. And I don't think it's Retina. I don't think the iPad 4 mini is a Retina display. And it's just fine. So, you know, I'm not one of those people who believes my eyes will be scratched out if I use a non-Retina display. But I think it's a good choice for a lot of people. And certainly the starting price, it's $329 for, you know, for everybody. I think it's $299 for educational, which I think is too expensive for schools, but okay. I think it's a good choice. I would recommend it to people who are kind of on the fence and, you know, don't want to spend $800 on a Pro, essentially.
What I worry about with the too expensive for schools issue, which I think is definitely an issue, is how will schools then get it? They will likely get it through grants. And as someone who has been in higher ed for a while and noticed this, you've got usually when it's a grant-funded program, someone who was very excited about it, they then wrote the grant, they got the grant, they used the products for approximately maybe a year or two, and then they didn't use them anymore or it didn't quite work out, and then the school is just left with a cart of iPads or a cart of iPods. And those things, after 3 or 4 years, are pretty much worthless. We ran across one at my institution a few years ago, and they asked me to take a look at them. And these were second-gen iPod Touches. today, to use a second-gen iPod Touch, if it doesn't already have the software loaded on it that you need, you're out of luck.
Yeah.
Because it can't connect to the App Store. It's not getting updates.
Yeah.
So with all things education, A, the way to go is not buying them in bulk for the school. It's having students bring them with them to school. So it's almost like you think of it as a school supply. And then parents are left with, what do you do with these things after they've lived their life? And then you find some way to deploy what you need to deploy in a global scale. So I could see a school using that as the way to get this, is that every student gets an iPad at the beginning of the year and they take it home at the end of the year with them, or after 2 years or something like that. But it's a weird world with technology. It's not the same as it used to be, where you bought a whole set of something, like a whole set of textbooks, and you use those for 10, 15 years in school.
Right. Even when they're wrong.
Yeah, even when they're wrong.
Because knowledge has changed in 10 years. Or not wrong, but aged out.
Well, and it's interesting that that's not even just knowledge as we think of it. That's historical understanding. You know, even a history book that you think of as, well, that's history. That, you know, that doesn't change. No, the way that people think about it does definitely change. And so you're going to have people saying, no, we don't think of this in the same way, because historians have reanalyzed it, or historians have argued over it, and those sorts of things.
Yeah. that, you know, the other thing is, because, you know, and we'll use the $299 school price, which I think is too expensive personally. First, it's for the 32 gigabyte storage, and I kind of wonder, you know, how if that's sufficient even for a child who's presumably going to be in a curriculum that expects them to do drawings and music and, you know, photography maybe, you know, and by photography, I mean photography for other, not for photography class, but photography for, say, a science class, or, you know, doing a field trip, or, you know, even history, if you go to visit a historical site, that sort of thing. That thing's going to fill up pretty fast. And I, as a person who made the mistake of buying a 32 gigabyte iPad Pro 9.7 2 years ago, I can tell you, I've got maybe 2.5 gigs free right now, and I don't really use it for, you know, a lot of storage stuff. I use it for mostly, you know, watching movies and doing my email and browsing and stuff like that, and it's still full.
Mm-hmm.
And I've removed all the music. I don't think I have any books on there. I don't store any video on there, and it's still full. I do have photos on there, but not a lot. You know, I don't take a lot of photos with an iPad Pro camera. I do a few, but not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it filled up, so I ended up buying the 10.5 last year with 256 gigs of storage, and that really helped. The other thing is that at $299, you still don't have a physical keyboard. And while maybe a K through 4 or 5 might be able to get by on an on-screen keyboard for papers and maybe handwriting lessons or something like that, I would be hard-pressed to imagine a high school student wanting to pump out a 5 or 10-page report on an on-screen keyboard. I mean, you can do it. I just think that that's maybe, you know, cruel and unusual. I think it's like unconstitutional or something.
So. Yeah, I agree that it's a weird – we'll have to see what Apple does with it. You know, they introduce some cool stuff. If they can figure out the right way to market it and figure out the right way to get students to use it in a way that educators go, yeah, that's pretty cool. I want my students doing this. Then they have a good shot.
Yeah.
If they don't, well, then these things are just going to be the low cost entry-level iPad.
Yeah. And, you know, I should note, I don't have any show notes, but the day before the Apple event, which was this past Tuesday, on Monday of this past week, Google announced their keyboardless, well, let's call it a tablet, a Chrome OS tablet from Acer, I believe. It's about the same price as iPads. It's no cheaper. But the advantage is Google's educational services work across platforms. So you don't have to have a Chrome OS device to use it. You can still use it if you're on a PC or Mac or even an iPad for that matter. So they have the advantage of scaling across platforms versus you got to have an iPad. I do wonder about why you would want a keyboardless, aka tablet, Chrome OS device. I mean, I use a Chrome OS device every day. That's the main thing I use every day at home, not at work. And I really like my Chrome OS device. It's a Samsung Chromebook Plus a year ago now. And it's great, but I can't imagine using it without a physical keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing before John gets to his rant is I have a, and it's not a rant, it's just an observation. So I was inspired by John, as I often am. I was inspired by John last week, who mentioned he was in the process of updating a bunch of his older Mac OS devices to, you know, various apps and presumably operating system. So I busted out my 2006 MacBook, which is the first Intel-based MacBook. It uses a Core Duo, not a Core 2 Duo. It uses Core Duo. It has a whole 1 gigabyte of RAM, and I think it has 64 gigs of storage. And it booted up fine. No problem. 12-year-old MacBook booted up fine. Of course, I can't upgrade it to High Sierra or anything like that. But here was the interesting thing. I also can't upgrade any of the browsers. Yeah, Safari, Chrome, Firefox. I can't upgrade it to anything that's considered modern. Right, and it, part of it is because it's a 32-bit OS I'm running still, I think. But in any case, I simply can't upgrade it. And as one of the side effects of it was, I said, I had a bunch of files on there. I said, you know, I don't know if I have these files in a backup format I like. I mean, I know I had them backed up on a hard drive, which still works. But, you know, I wanted to put them in OneDrive or, you know, someplace like that, or Google Drive. And I thought, well, you know, I'll just go to the, I'll pop open a browser and I'll start uploading a bunch of things and then I'll, you know, shut down the MacBook and put it away for another couple of years. But guess what? Google Drive and other things don't work in older browsers. It will say, you know, we don't support this browser. You need to upgrade the browser, but if you can't upgrade your browser, you're kind of in a tough situation.
Yeah.
So,
and I do believe there are some legacy browser, you know, there's a homebrew community for everything. And I know there are communities out there that do something with these older devices, but tracking them down is kind of the hard.
I'd probably have to run Linux on it, basically. You know, is rebuild it using Linux instead of Mac OS. But I don't know. I mean, I don't need to do it, so it's not a big deal. I've got other Mac devices to use. And it's only got 1 gig of RAM. I think I can upgrade it to 2, but even there, you know, right? Although Linux would run fine on 2 gigs. But anyway, so that was an interesting finding. I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was. I ended up just grabbing a big USB thumb drive. And fortunately, since it was only a 64 gigabyte hard drive in the MacBook, a 128 gigabyte stick, and basically everything's backed up, no problem. In addition to the, you know, Time Machine backup. Okay, John. Let's hear your rant.
Well, okay, so my rant is, it's going to seem to be a weird one, because if you are of a certain age, and that's actually people younger than I am, you're going to go, well, why do you care? Not recently. I've been struggling with this for a while. So in the 2000s, back in the era of Todd's MacBook that he just talked about, I was an avid Microsoft Money user. And I used Microsoft Money for everything I was doing. I wasn't doing that much at that time. I wasn't doing a lot of investing. I wasn't doing anything more than really making sure that I had enough money to survive that week. But it was a useful tool. And then Microsoft discontinued it, much like many things that I've loved over the years. From Microsoft and Apple and Google.
Yes.
So I, in 2009, started using Mint.com. Mint.com is a very popular cloud-based personal finance program, and it actually syncs up with pretty much everyone you would ever imagine you'd want to download your financial information from. It has great export abilities in that you can export all of the transactions from all of the accounts in one big CSV file. So you can slice it and dice it however you want in Excel or Access or whatever you want to do. And, of course, it categorizes things properly by itself. And it has budgeting capabilities and build scheduling and all that. The problem is Mint.com's infrastructure is kind of garbage. It takes forever to do updates of all these things when you're downloading new transactions. The interface is kind of clunky. There are still parts of it that are in Flash, which just don't run on most modern browsers today. So you look at it and you think, don't really know if I want to keep using this. And plus, it's all cloud-based, so you can't run it on a local computer. For a few years, I tried using a piece of software called Banktivity, which was formerly called iBank. I kind of went away from Mint and used that. It was a little bit better in that it was local, desktop-based, but it was Mac only. It doesn't run on anything other than a Mac, and it also has some issues with downloading and syncing and those sorts. So I recently decided I'm going to try to break away from Mint once again. I found a piece of software called Money Dance, all one word. Money Dance is sort of a cross-platform. It runs on Mac, Windows, Linux, and also has iOS and Android apps that can read and sync data from it. It syncs everything through Dropbox, so you actually have a physical file that is your file, and it's encrypted. So I'm going to try using this, but my basic rant is, why doesn't anyone want to use desktop software to manage their finances anymore? Money is gone. Quicken, from every review I've read, seems to be garbage. It's subscription-based now, and it also stores all of your data in the cloud. And all the other options I've found are pretty much focused on fixing bad financial habits. So if you're the kind of person who really has trouble sticking to a budget or really doesn't know, you know, just needs to have kind of safeguards in place to keep you from your own worst enemy, which is yourself,
right?
Then they're great options. But if you just want to be able to track your accounts and use something that sort of looks like an old-school check register, and also track your investments and download updates and keep it all in sync and be able to access it on your phone and on your computers, you're really at a very disadvantaged place right now. Money Dance is really the only thing I've been finding, and it's actually reasonably priced. It's only $50, and that's a one-time charge. So I'll see. I'll update in the future weeks if I'm able to get it working for my situation. But I don't know, Todd, what do you think? Is it just that we're weirdos that we actually want to track this stuff?
Well, I haven't tracked it in years. So, you know,
I'm a weirdo who wants to track this stuff.
So like you, I used Quicken and then I used Microsoft Money. I actually preferred Microsoft Money. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, it either I got tired of it or it just disappeared, or maybe the two happened at the same time. And then there wasn't anything else, like you said. Or, you know, and Mint came along years later, as I recall.
Yes.
So by then, I kind of lost interest in the whole thing. And
money. And having money. You know, your daughter was getting ready to go to school, too. So you were trying to lose interest in having money at that point.
Yeah. So, you know, and I guess the tools available at the various financial institutions I deal with, and I don't have a lot of them, but, you know, a few I do, they're online management tools, or, you know, just, I wouldn't even call it management, just, you know, how much do I have and where is it, were sufficient for me. And I didn't need to combine those views from, you know, multiple institutions to have a full view. I could kind of do that in my head. You know, I'm not a multi-bazillionaire, you know, so it's not like I have, you know, billions here and billions there and, you know, do I have 10 or 20 billion? No, that's not the problem. So I had enough tools online with the institutions to do what I needed to do, you know, to track, to do trend analysis and that sort of thing. And so I never really looked for a tool again.
Yeah, I think I'm the weirdo. I think a lot of people, and now I don't particularly have a lot of things at a lot of different financial institutions, but I do have investments at one institution and then another institution where I just have a very small investment account. So two investment institutions. And then two banks and three credit cards.
Yeah.
And so you really sort of, I don't think I have a lot of things that I need to track, but
it
seems like that's asking a lot to not have to log into three or four apps to just be able to log into one.
Yeah, you're all right. It does sound convenient. But being poor, I don't have a lot to manage, I guess. You know, having paid off 4 years of college and now graduate school. I don't have a lot of money left to manage, and it's just not an issue.
Well, so we have Todd's solution to the problem, which is just get poor.
Just be poor.
Yeah. I guess that's one way to go about it.
That's why I drive a 10-year-old car. No, sorry, 11. But in any case, so that's John's rant. It wasn't quite as ranty as I thought it would be. So that's
well,
good.
And also, I mean, the software that you do have access to, I mean, even Money Dance, I'm going through and having to fix issues with it.
Yeah.
That
their problem is the name. They need to call it
Money Waltz or.
Well, I was thinking, you know, I think if they want to be you know, trendy, they need to call themselves Money Blockchain.
Ooh, you're right. Even if Money Blockchain.
Even if they don't actually use blockchain technology. Like I told you, I'm thinking about changing the name of this podcast to a mobile blockchain. Just
a mobile blockchain.
Because it's just trendy.
It is. Isn't that sad?
Oh, remember that iced tea company that changed their thing to some blockchain thing? And
oh, yeah.
But anyway, we actually know what it means.
Yeah.
More or less. You know, I learned everything about blockchain technology from the recent John Oliver episode, but and it's still, you know, still, that's education. All right, John. So I updated my iPhone and iPad to iOS 11.3, upgraded my watch to 4.3. I did notice the change in the nightstand mode that I mentioned earlier. I'll look forward to hearing what you have to say about the... You have a brand new phone, though, so you won't notice any performance difference. I need to still see if I see a performance increase on my, you know, 18-month-old phone or however old it is. But we'll see. Oh, and my wife is my wife has a very old iPad. I think she's using an iPad 2 from work. And I gave her my iPad 2, so she has two iPad 2s, you know, for personal stuff. And she's thinking about buying the new iPad, so we might have one in the house to take a look at.
Hmm.
If she lets me look at it.
Well, if you know, you're allowed.
You know, like when my daughter was little, we had the Nintendo DS. I don't know if you remember the Nintendo DS, which is a very cool. The DS was, I think, a double screen. Mm-hmm. So it was a very cool game machine. It had some really cool games, I thought, like Animal Crossing and things like that, and Nintendogs. And I wanted to try it. And I said, I told my daughter, can I try your Nintendo DS? And she kind of looks at me very suspiciously, clutching her Nintendo DS, and says, why? Says, I want to try Nintendogs and Animal Crossing. No, you're going to mess up the game. So I never actually got to try it.
That's a little sad.
Yeah, I almost bought my own Nintendo DS, but I thought that was a little weird. So I did.
That seems like it might have been justified in this case, since your own daughter wouldn't let you play with hers.
Yeah. I do have it now, since you know it's sitting somewhere, you know, probably in a little plastic box. So I should see if it fires up. Maybe I can try the Nintendogs and Animal Crossing after
finally.
Yeah, after 17 years, however long it's been. Alrighty, that brings an end to MobileViews podcast number 248. Hey, we should invite some folks for number 250 in 2 weeks. I will check with John after the podcast what his schedule's like. He's a pretty busy guy, so we'll see when he's available, and we'll meet back for 249 and then episode 250. We will talk to you next time.